we went from 28 restaurants to 80 restaurants in one day. And that really began who we were.
Ja, unglaublich, aber wahr. Wir haben heute Europas größten Gastronomen zu Gast. Es handelt sich um astronomische Zahlen. Wir werden genauer darüber sprechen. Welcome, Henry McGovern.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Should we start with tasting the microphone? Because we said it's already 11:30 and we can't get too close enough, the project management said. So
it's in our face, but it's probably good to cover my face a little bit. It's probably okay.
Camera on Henry McGovern, please. So let's start with word wrap. 10 questions.
Okay.
You have to choose one.
Okay.
There's no escape.
There's right? no escape.
No, there's no escape. Okay.
Michelin.
Cow milk or soya milk?
Oh, cow milk. Goat milk that preferred.
Goat milk?
Fresh though.
Nice.
Has to be fresh.
Nice.
Yeah.
So raw milk.
Raw milk. Raw milk. I have 3 goats at my house.
Okay, let's talk about this
later.
Later. It's great. Nice one. The US or Poland?
Oh, tough one. All depends on the issue at hand. Let's go with US and A.
Wine or beer?
Wine.
That was very...
very easy.
That was easy.
I love beer. Don't get me wrong. I love vodka, but don't get me wrong.
But. Fish or meat?
Oh.
We have been at the fish restaurant yesterday. People have to know that, so maybe...
See, I like everything.
Even the microphone.
Even the microphone is good. No, I really like, I love food. So yeah, let's go with both. You know, when given a choice, you should take both.
You have one joker.
No, but when you're given a choice, you take both. So if I can have fish and steak, why not surf and turf, no?
Yeah, okay. I'm convinced it's not that difficult.
No, I don't have to choose in this world. This world has abundance. It's really good.
That's something... which really fits you to say that. But we will talk about this as well later. Yes. The person you would love to have dinner with, no matter if this person is still alive or not.
Will Smith.
Okay. That was easy as well. Fries or nachos?
Nachos.
Nutella with or without butter?
Without.
Pizza with ananas, yes or
no?
No,
come no on. Way. No way.
You're not that Italian, though.
No, but no. It doesn't work.
All right. Let's start with our conversation.
Please.
Henry, you're one of, let's say, the biggest restaurateurs in Europe, maybe even in the world. I think it's always very tricky to say that, but you have many, many restaurants which were part of MREST, which you founded.
Yes.
Are you the biggest restaurateur in the world, actually? Can it
be? I don't think so.
You don't think so? Who would be bigger?
Probably the Alsea group from Mexico.
Yeah.
There are a few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, as a matter of fact, you started with very little. You were... born in the USA.
Yes.
And you started with a tennis shop, actually. Is this right?
That's correct. Yeah.
How did this start?
That started thanks to my sister. She dated a tennis pro. And so she invited... Actually, it came from being in Germany, since we're sitting here in Düsseldorf. I was in...
Because you grew up a little bit in Germany, right?
A little bit. Or 4 and 5 years old. But when I was 13... or 12, excuse me, my parents decided I needed a little bit of discipline, and there's no better place than Germany for a little bit of discipline. So they shipped me off to close to Ettal. Kennst du Ettal?
Ettal.
Ettal, it is ein Kloster.
Okay.
In the mountains near Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
All right, I see.
Yeah, and I only lasted 4 months, and I tell you a really quick, funny story. So I really didn't like it. My father was pretty strict, or is pretty strict. And so I come home for Christmas and I'm like, I really don't want to go back. Like it just doesn't fit me, right? an 11th century, you know, monastery in the German Alps is not exactly
very
my kind of
very
thing.
Very Catholic as
yeah,
well.
Very yeah, very Catholic. So my father surprisingly says, it's okay. You don't have to go back. And I'm like, wow, that was way easier than I expected. So for 32 years, I thought my father was like cool for that day or something. And my wife is going through the old family photo albums because she wants to create some frames for our house. And she finds this letter from Etal. And it says, Dear Mr. and Mrs. McGovern, we think it would be better if Henry didn't come back after Christmas. So I never knew all of these years that, actually I wasn't invited back. I thought I got out of it.
Because you were so indisciplined there, you think?
Yes, for sure. That would be a different podcast to tell you the mess I made at Etal. But anyway, I came back and, my sister was like, you know, it's the middle of the school year. He's all messed up anyway. Maybe he can come help us set up this tennis shop. And then when my sister broke up with her boyfriend, I was the natural one to take her place. So I stayed friends with the boyfriend, probably closer than with my sister. I shouldn't say that out loud. But anyway, we
had a great time. But it was a business reasoning already then. Yeah. How old were you at the
Well, when I took over, I was 15. And I stayed there until I was 20. So we did 8 years. And that was the 1980s in the Hamptons. That was in West Hampton. If anybody knows New York in the 80s, it was crazy time. And really, that was a wonderful time. And I learned a lot, obviously, running a shop when you're that young and managing everything in cash and customer service. And we did a lot of things at people's private homes. We taught tennis lessons at private homes. We took care of their courts. We did a lot. So it was a great experience.
You were 15 until 2022, you said. Did you finish high school next to it? How was it? Because you seemed, it seems as if you were very engaged and ambitious with this shop.
Yes.
However, at this age, people have obligations.
School. No, yeah, it was only open in the summer.
All right.
So we were open from May through September.
Yeah.
So I usually missed a little bit of school at the end and a little bit at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then I went on to Georgetown University. And then at Georgetown is when I stopped going up to, for the summers.
How did restaurants
happen.
Come into play? How did food restaurants?
By
how did
accident.
This, by accident.
By accident. Actually, I was studying pre-med at Georgetown. I thought I was going to go and be a surgeon, but when I was getting close, I never finished university. I decided, oof, I'm going to be 30 when I get out of medical school. That doesn't fit me. So I thought about what else I could do. And it was the time of, you know, the fall of the wall. So it was very
so
important 89, here
1989,
in Germany.
90,
And I was finishing in 1989 at Georgetown. And I thought, gosh, what am I going to do? So I decided that I would come take a look at what the fall of the wall looked like. Then I ended up, because of some business reasons, I had started when I was at Georgetown, I had started a real estate company. I was a manager of off-campus housing, and I bought a number of houses and renovated a number of houses
around
it. There
was always this...
Always there.
You always wanted to do business, actually, right?
That's why I quit medical school, because I kind of realized that... business was more interesting to me. So it took me a couple of years, and then I came over in 1992, and I was coming for just a look, a life experience. I tell people, at that time, it was really quite obvious that that was the most interesting thing in the world. And if you look back over history, usually in a decade, there was the things that were most interesting things in the world, like going to the moon in the 60s, or the 1940s was obviously the war, and 1920s was, you know... But now it's hard because so many things are changing in biotech and AI and robotics. You can, there are just a lot of interesting things in the world. But back then, the fall of the wall was clearly the most interesting thing in the world.
Especially from an American perspective, which wanted to do business, right?
Yeah, when I really wasn't thinking about business because I was trying to figure out what I was going to do after changing.
So it was pure curiosity.
Pure curiosity. I came over. I needed to pay for myself because I didn't have enough money to live without paying myself. So what I thought I would do is buy one building, renovate it, sell it, and that would pay for my year. So that's what I did. I came, I bought a building.
So where in Europe?
In Breslau.
In Poland. Breslau. In yeah. Breslau in Poland. So
yeah.
I think this is quite interesting as well, because as we know from history, Poland had a very rough switch from the communist way of life to the capitalistic new way of life. I think many people knew if you want to try to do business immediately in the post-Soviet Union, Poland is a place to be, right? I mean, yeah.
Obvious in 1992.
Okay,
It's been incredible. When I came to Poland, the average salary was $250 a month.
All right, yeah.
So, you know, India a few years ago, very poor.
Yeah. So you came to Breslau, you bought a building with the money you already made in the US, right, with your real estate business?
Yes, and I got a partner because I didn't have enough money, and we renovated the building, and then I was going to rent the ground floor to a restaurant because it made the most sense, but nobody was ready to go to Breslau, so I ended up saying, okay, well, by a bit of luck, a little bit of, you know, that's the way life is. It goes your way sometimes. I met the CEO of PepsiCo a few years before, and I tried to lease the ground floor to PepsiCo, and they told me no. And the CEO said, well, if my company's not smart enough to do it, maybe you want to do it by yourself. And so we opened with him as my partner. His name is Don Kendall. We opened up a Pizza Hut on the ground floor of this building, but not like a Pizza Hut you've ever seen. A really nice dine-in restaurant is kind of funny for people to think about.
But it was a franchise from Pizza Hut.
So I got a franchise.
At the time, I got a franchise.
All right. And that's how I ended up in the restaurant business. I had never worked in a restaurant, or I didn't know anything. Here you are
with a Pizza Hut in Breslau.
Yeah.
As an American who wanted to have a look.
Exactly.
All right.
So 1 year became two became four. And I always said I was leaving in 2 years. 30 years later, a wife and four children, still here.
Still in Warsaw.
Now I live in Prague.
In Prague, all right.
Czech Republic, because my son plays ice hockey for Sparta.
All right.
So it's fun.
So this was the beginning with a Pizza Hut. So how did this become this gigantic thing you
one
have
at a time
now? Yeah, is it?
Oh, no, yeah, really. It's like any good, I think, entrepreneurial story. One restaurant, we opened the second one in Stettin. Mm-hmm. And then we opened the third one back in Breslau. And we just kept going. And then in 1997, we got a bit of a change. It was quite difficult in Poland because PepsiCo bought the largest chocolate company called Wedel. Mm-hmm. And they decided they did not want us in Poland because they wanted it all for equity. And so that created some tensions and then an opportunity to go to the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. So we bought five restaurants in the Czech Republic, and we started to build there. And
what kind of restaurants?
That was a KFC.
A KFC.
So fast food.
All right.
Yeah.
So it was clear for you, you wanted to focus on this kind of restaurants where there is a system behind it, which are run by very clear workflows. There was never this.
Yes and no. Yeah. I think what you have to remember is what I told you in the beginning, how poor the countries were. So affordability was very important. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then remember, myself nor no one in the region had ever worked in a restaurant. So when I came to Breslau, there were 700,000 people. There were three restaurants.
Wow.
So communism didn't have restaurants.
Yes, of course.
So no one had experience, right? So there were no you didn't go hire, and I couldn't afford to go to another country because remember how low salaries were. So I couldn't go to London or come over here to Germany and hire managers. We had to build up local people. So we were all young. We were all in our 20s. And, you know, we just started doing this. One of the speakers later today is Jacek Trzybachowski. Yeah. Jacek worked in our second restaurant. And we all just built from, we just built from nothing. But what made us special was how much we focused on people. We were a training culture. It was super fun corporate culture. Like everything at Amrest was just built from the people.
So when did this, this restaurants which you started to buy and to create step by step, when did this become something which you wanted to have sort of bounded in this Amrest? When did Amrest become a thing for you?
Actually, pretty early. So when we went to Czech, we started realizing, because when I started, again, I started thinking about real estate, right? So I kept doing the real estate until 1997 as well. So the restaurants were the smaller side. I was buying a building, putting a restaurant inside, buying a building, putting a restaurant inside.
So that was actually the approach.
That
right?
was the business.
Buying a building,
put a restaurant
putting a restaurant, and the restaurants in and mainly franchise.
And then there was offices or whatever else. Mainly all
mainly,
franchise.
Mainly
all
franchise. Yeah.
All franchise. And so when we went to Czech Republic, we bought restaurants, not buildings.
Oh, okay.
They were existing five restaurants. And that changed us into a restaurant company. And we stopped really doing the real estate because of capital constraints. And return on capital in restaurants is better than return on capital in real estate. Most people don't think that, but return on restaurants is much better than return on real estate. So, yeah, we did that. And then in 1999, I told you that PepsiCo tried to build everything in Poland by themselves. Mm. Of course, that didn't go so well for them. They lost a lot of money. So in 1999, I had the opportunity to buy out the PepsiCo restaurants. We did that in August of 1999, which was great because it was the franchisee taking over the franchisor, which doesn't happen very often.
Yeah,
so you can imagine
exactly.
the surprise on all of the franchisor's faces.
Wow.
So then we were 100 restaurants.
So this was quite a boost.
That was
for
a
your
huge
business.
Change for us. We went from 28 restaurants to 80 restaurants in one day. And that really began who we were because we turned their business around. We added 18 points to the P&L in a very short period of time. So we took a money-losing business. We made it profitable. That gave everybody a lot of confidence that we could do things. So we ended up then getting new brands, going into new countries, and that was kind of the beginning. And then in 2005, we took the company public, and that was kind of the next
big move. It went to the
Warsaw Stock Exchange.
Yes, to the Stock Exchange.
Yes,
thank
exactly.
you for helping out.
Yeah.
And how did this affect the business? Did it become more complicated with that? Was it something where you said, no, it was the complete logical next step in order to become even more profitable? How was that?
Yeah, I don't know about profitable, but we were a growth company. Mm-hmm. Again, we had a lot of young people, so everybody wanted to see us growing, right? It just had that culture of let's go, we can do a lot. It was definitely a work hard, play hard culture, so people wanted to do things. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, those were the boom years of Central Europe. By 2007,
at the beginning of the
mid 2000s, and even still today. I mean, it's crazy that Poland, while the rest of Western Europe or the rest of the world had a recession during the 2008 financial crisis.
Yes,
the GDP of Poland never fell. So it's 28 years. Where the Polish economy has not had a recession. So,
really?
Yeah, it's the second fastest growing economy.
Up to this day?
Up to this day.
All right.
Incredible, no?
I didn't know that.
Really. Yeah, nobody, you know, people, especially in Germany, I think Germany still thinks there's a big barrier between Poland and Germany.
Yes. And we get a lot of bad news also in Austria about Poland, you know. But
yeah. It's not true. And Poland today, I mean, if you went to Warsaw, it's got more going on in the restaurant space. Like Warsaw is a more dynamic restaurant space than I can't name a city in Germany that has the kind of
really,
yeah, excitement, new concepts, really. And it's about the same price as Germany now. That's how quickly the economy has improved.
What is quite interesting is that at the beginning you mentioned you were investing a lot of a lot in people's ability in training
yes.
of the people. Did this still was a thing when you started in the Czech Republic where restaurants were already existing? So was this an approach which paid afterwards as well?
Yeah, I mean, it came because there was nobody with training. So
yeah.
It was necessity, but then it became the culture. So we really realized that's what made a difference because people in that part of the world were very positive on their right. I would call it like Poles and Czechs, they felt European. So that 50 years under communism was just a bad time. They wanted to get back to where they were. So the work ethic, everything was very high. And so they loved training. They valued the training. So, you know, I used to joke, we're more of a training company than we are a restaurant company because the amount of time. And we did a lot of very interesting things. We had a whole process for the way we promoted people that was different than I've ever seen in the industry before. We called them review boards. So a lot of leadership time into everybody getting promoted. So
we did a lot. So this was a key element in the success, investing in training people, keeping people in the company.
Yeah, our tenure was way above the norm in the industry. And
because that's the thing, of course, in many restaurants, and I think the more high-end you get, the more you see people come and go.
Yep.
Was this, or is this, or was this something that was very important to you to keep?
Yeah, people... again, the culture was so good, people didn't usually want to leave. Like our top people, I think we probably averaged 15 years at the company or something.
All right. I mean, it's interesting to see that in this particular context, this was a key element to have an investment in the people, right? It's something that resonates, I think, a lot with other restaurateurs, especially today, because a lot of restaurants have important or big problems because they don't have enough people or not people who know.
Right. Yeah, I find it really interesting. Now, I guess we'll talk about McWynn, my new business after I sold Amrest. But we go in to great businesses. I mean, like, I don't know if you've been to any of our Big Mama restaurants, but phenomenal culture, great group of people. But still, that added element of some of the things that we talk about, like review boards, just increasing the commitment to people training and development. It's really good.
So you already told us now, at a specific point, I think it was 2015, right? You sold
19.
Amrest. 19, sorry. You sold Amrest. Why and what came afterwards?
COVID came afterwards, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
So the why is I was always saying I was going to sell in 2 years, and I think my wife got sick of hearing it. we have four children, and at that time we had four children living in four different countries. Mm-hmm. And my wife was like, just stop and let's get things together.
How many restaurants were at part of Amrest at the time?
2,300. Yeah. 55,000 people or something like that. So it was good.
Yeah. It was good.
No one expected, one restaurant out of Breslau, Poland to end up Europe's leading restaurant company. So that was fun. Amazing. So I did not think I would go back into restaurants at all. That was not the plan. I think what's going on in food technology is very important. What's not usually known about Amrest is we had a very big food supply business as well, because again, when I moved to Poland, there were no, mozzarella cheese factories or tortilla factories or, chicken cutting. Those things didn't exist.
So you implied this as well.
So we had to build up the capability in systems. All there. Right. People also think because you're a franchisee, that the franchisor does that. But not when you're in a new country, like mm-hmm. where we were. Mm-hmm. They would usually want to supply you from existing mm-hmm. supply chain.
Supply chain, yeah.
But that wasn't affordable to us, so we had to build up our own supply chain.
Which
so,
is also a sort of freedom, no?
Definitely. It became more than a freedom. It became a like a security wall around us. It made it a competitive advantage. But therefore, I got to see a lot of, you know, the food chain and where things were broken. And I do think our factory farming system that we have today is not sustainable. It's not sustainable from a health point of view. It's not sustainable from an environmental point of view. So I've been interested in the technology that takes us forward. And that's what I thought I would start spending most of my time on. But then COVID came, and it was lucky that I sold the company before COVID.
Yes. So 2019, you sold it. 2020, as we know.
6 months later.
6 months later, COVID March comes. 2020.
Yeah, exactly.
COVID comes.
Yeah. So I got a lot of phone calls, of course. Mm. Can you help me? What are your thoughts? What should mm-hmm. happen? Spoke to a lot of people, and then decided to get back into restaurants. There was a business in the UK, Gale's Bakery, which I tried to buy while I was at Amrest, was very close. Mm-hmm. They didn't close the deal when I left. So that mm-hmm. that was an interesting opportunity right away. And that was the first investment we made out of our fund, was into Gale's. And before that, I was primarily investing off of my own balance sheet with my partner, Steve Winiger. Yeah. And Steve and I, we thought long and hard about it, but with the disruption from COVID, we decided mm-hmm. to get into having a fund and opening it up to other people's investment as well. And I think that's gone really well.
So this is what you have done since this new, let's say, focus on food innovation, food technology.
Yeah.
How does it work? Is there something which you can maybe give us an example how such an investment, what is specifically interesting in a specific investment?
Sure, I can give you a couple. I'll give you three that are on the food side, because we also mm-hmm. do like hard technology, but okay. we all understand software, hardware. Yeah. But let me give you some food technology examples. One is in a space which 10 years from now, I think we'll all look at and say, wow, that was pretty obvious. It's in mm-hmm. the protein fermentation segment. Mm-hmm. It's egg protein specifically. Mm-hmm. So we make, in an egg, you have a lot of proteins, about 100 of them. But there are a couple that do the majority of the work of an egg. But eggs are in everything. I mean, I don't even know. Most people don't probably realize, unless you have an allergy to that mm-hmm. protein, which very few people have. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's a binding agent in almost everything that's baked. There's or an egg glaze to give it a shine.
Pasta,
or
whatever.
Pasta. It's everywhere because eggs have so many functions. They mm-hmm. have hard proteins. They have binding proteins. They
or the texture.
If you think about meringue
yes,
froths up
fluffers.
Because yeah. of an egg. You have to separate the egg white from the... Mm. So eggs have very specific functions. But the factory farming of chickens and eggs, we read about it all the time. And then every, 3 years, 4 years, there's an avian flu.
Yeah.
And then is a huge disruption. And there's a scandal and... It's just like this regular cycle yeah. because we have billions, actually hundreds of billions of chicken eggs coming out every year. Mm. It's a $200 billion addressable market. And we do it the old way. We have these big chicken coops where everybody's kept tight and we take the eggs out and nobody sees it, so nobody complains about it, right? But then we mm-hmm. get the avian flu and it's a mess. Mm-hmm. So the company is called The Every Company, and it's based in San Francisco, and we are fermenting that protein onto Pichia, we extract it just like a beer, just like making beer yeast, yes, yeah. just like the brewing process of that, and we extract that protein, And then that protein goes into your baked goods or anything. And just this week, we launched our first product with Quest into Walmart. So kind of a
big
week
step.
Because it's now out in the consumer space. And then you have different proteins for different things, like we were saying. So if you want something for egg whites versus, you know, making an omelet, they're different. So we're not, you know, we can't make it yet at the price of a chicken. So chicken liquid egg costs you about $35 a kilo for just a liquid egg. And we're right around 2.5 times that at the moment. But within a year, we'll be equal to the chicken price. And then I think it's there's no reason for factory farming. So our goal is to eliminate factory farming of eggs by 2040. And that feels
That's a big goal.
Big goal. So and it feels realistic if, you know, we just need to put in, it's a lot of facilities that are needed to replace that many eggs, a lot of fermentation, a lot of tanks. But it's something that's doable, and it's much more environmentally friendly. It's like insane. True. It's insane, the numbers, how much better it is. And it's clean, and then there's no avian flu, and there's no, you know, there's no salmonella, there's no all of the issues that come with the factory farming of egg.
It's a very stupid question, but I can't find an answer in my head. Is it a vegan product then?
It's a great question. Yes, it will be interesting how every country does it. The United States has decided that it's a vegan product. Because yes, it's only grown on a, you know, so it's just fermented.
It's fermented,
So it is. The original cell, of course, came from a chicken, that's quite long ago now because we've been working it.
Yeah, so there is actually... One could say yes, because there is no
animal involved.
Right?
That's correct. So it is a vegan product.
Wow. That's super fascinating.
It's a vegan product with all the, with a bioidentical, and it's not genetically modified. So you don't have any of the GMO problems. You don't have any of those. It's a bioidentical protein.
And I mean, I think we don't know yet, but do you think consumers are ready for that?
Oh, I think the consumer wants price, unfortunately, convenience. And then unfortunately, the rest of it is secondary. But when you find out something has the same price, tastes better or the same, and then happens to have all of these other benefits, yes. Because again, I think if it was altered or synthetic or something, then you might say, is the consumer ready for it? But the consumer is just going to pick up the package and it's going to say egg protein.
Yeah, right. Just fermented. And people love fermented stuff.
Don't taste any fermentation. It's just a protein,
right?
Yeah,
but it's not, fermented is not a bad word.
No, it's not a bad word. Correct.
I mean, like in the consumer's head.
That's right.
So this is the next goal, is to eliminate
factory farming of eggs. Yes.
On up to 2040. 40.
Yeah.
So these are 15 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Doable?
Doable. Doable. If governments, you know, get behind it and realize, like, Europe still hasn't approved it. America has, some other countries have approved it. Europe is so slow with all of its regulatory issues, but it will come because it's in the consumer's best interest. So
you think there will at a certain time not be any other way for the European Union, for example, to say no to this.
I think Germany, for example, is kind of crazy that they're not more on this. They have a huge tradition in fermenting beer, but the beer industry has been going down, 2% for 15 years in a row or something. Why aren't they investing into the newest wave of fermentation? So I think the German, you know, the brewing industry should be completely behind this. It's in their best interest and they should be switching over.
Is this also part of your job now, to argue for such kind of changes towards important stakeholders at a state level, or is this a wrong impression of
We're not doing that as McWin. We have a few conversations, but we really put that on the company themselves, with some advice and guidance of how do you get, you know, government grants and how do you get the government involved. It's been going pretty well, though, getting government approvals has not mm-hmm. been, because, you know, again, they're generally accepted standards to what food safety looks like.
Yeah.
And this meets all of those. So we're not inventing something that is so new that it doesn't fall under generally accepted standards of food yeah. safety.
Yeah. Would this kind of innovation be possible, let's say, 10 years ago?
No, because, you know, I'll switch to the second company that I was going to describe to you. It's called Nuritas out of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And they identify peptides that have very specific functions. So peptides, for everyone, are just the building blocks of a protein. They're just basically short right. proteins. Mm-hmm. But more and more research shows that peptides are the driving factor of, you know, high quality sleep, muscle building, gut, brain bacteria communication. They're involved in everything. So I think you'll see over the next, you know, again, 10 years that the use and understanding of peptides becomes massive. Mm-hmm. So most mm-hmm. peptides in the world that, well, there are billions or trillions. We don't even know how many peptides there are. There's more peptides than there are stars in the universe type thing. It's one of those that's so big we don't even know how to. A single apple has like a million peptides in it. So it's kind of crazy. But because there's so many, nobody has known exactly which one is doing what. We know if you eat a banana, you know, it's going to help you fall asleep, for example. Mm. We don't know if, is there a peptide in the banana that's doing that, or is it in, you know, where is it? Yeah. Or, you know, even stuff we don't use, like the husk of rice, it's all in there, but we don't use that currently. Yeah. So what's in there we could use. And so a mathematician out of Ireland, a woman, is using AI now. She was doing it out of her mathematics ability previously, but now AI helps dramatically with identifying what peptides are doing what. So the company has an entire AI module. So think of a large language model just focused on identifying peptides that do very specific things. So
this is also
collagen in your skin, or building lean muscle mass, or sleep, or, you know, looking for ones that help manage sugar. And so that's clearly where 10 years ago you just didn't have the compute power and the modules to do that.
But so interesting to see where AI comes into play in the food technology. I mean, it's a perfect example.
Yeah, right? So you can look up PeptiStrong. PeptiStrong is a product we're out in the market with, or PeptiSleep, and they're very specific peptides to help in things. So if you go to the gym, you should be taking PeptiStrong. Even if you don't go to the gym, you should be taking PeptiStrong.
What I find very interesting is that actually it's the second wave of completely new era which you're surfing on, so to say, because after the fall of the wall, you were seizing the opportunity, and now you seize the opportunity of the new power of AI, right?
Yep.
It's for sure. Quite interesting.
For sure.
Are there any other long-term plans than to eradicate egg farming until 2040?
Look, I think the industry is exciting. It's constantly evolving. I try to tell people, you know, when all the aggregators started, like Lieferando or Uber Eats or Foodora or whichever they were, they created more value in the restaurant industry in a 10-year period than the entire restaurant industry did out of public offerings in Europe in the previous 30 years.
Really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So unfortunately, like, why wasn't that done by restaurant people? It was, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
That's going to happen again. That's where we are in the process, because the world is going to shift, and Europeans aren't quite ready for it, because Europeans, again, too much regulation, too much control. But if you look at, like, talking about Ireland, there's a drone company there, Manna Drones, and they are really delivering product 2.5 minutes on average. In the United States, there are like 10 or 12 cities already using drones. Autonomous vehicles. my daughter lives in San Francisco. She gets in a Waymo once a week. And it's normal. It's on her phone, just call it up. She gets in a driverless car. It's
unconceivable in Europe.
Yeah, right. Everybody's like, what are we talking about? But yeah. San Francisco is a more complicated city to drive in than...
Absolutely, than Warsaw.
Yeah, than Warsaw or Dusseldorf where we sit, right? What's even crazier in America is there's like three or four companies competing. So it's not even just one, right? It's like standard business behavior. Four companies have launched. We have competition. And in Europe, like, what the hell? Like, hello, let's wake up. So I think that disruption is going to come again. It's going to come right on top of, you know, the last one. And it's the restaurant business needs to evolve and create out of that.
I think that's a very nice almost end to our podcast. But now comes the last little tricky question. From all the restaurants you built or helped to build, is there one where you love or loved to sit? Just one.
You know the answer to that. Parents love all their children.
No. One.
No, I don't think
you have to choose one.
I don't think I can give you one.
I mean, to be
there
fair,
there is something special about the upstairs of Pink Mama in Paris. There's something really special about sitting up there. So let's go with that one.
Let's
for
go
today.
With that.
Just that
the
one.
The Big
today.
Mama upstairs in Paris.
Yeah, Pink Mama upstairs. It's really nice. But then you get a drink all the way downstairs in the speakeasy afterwards. So, you know.
Which is nice as well. No?
Which is also pretty cool.
Great.
Yeah.
Henry McGovern, thank you so much for taking
you.
The time.
It was great. Thanks
great.
A lot.
Thank you. Das war's.
Okay.
Okay, can we take a quick picture?
Oh, yes.
Take a quick picture for sure.